Greetings, everybody, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Christy Batterman Jordan, a member of the club's Environmental and Natural Resource Forum, and your chair for today. It's my pleasure to welcome any new members to the club who are here. We know you will enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you here often. We are recording today's program, so please make sure now that all cell phones and portable devices are turned off. Anything with an on-off switch, right? And now I'll begin tonight's program. Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Christy Batterman Jordan, a member of the club's Environment and Natural Resource Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Dr. Peter H. Glick is president and co-founder of the Pacific Institute for Studies in Development, Environment, and Security in Oakland, California. He is an internationally recognized water expert whose research and writings focus on the critical connections between water and human health, the hydrologic impacts of climate change, sustainable water use, privatization and globalization, and the international conflicts over water resources. In 2003, Dr. Glick was named a MacArthur Fellow. The British Broadcasting Corporation has called him a visionary on the environment. He has been elected an academician of the International Water Academy in Oslo, Norway, and in 2006, he was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in Washington, D.C. Dr. Glick is the author of many scientific papers and 9 books, including the biennial water report, The World's Water, and Bottled and Sold, the story behind our obsession with bottled water. His newest book, A 21st Century U.S. Water Policy, has just been published by Oxford University Press. You can find more information about the Pacific Institute on their website at www.pacinst.org. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Peter Glick.
Thank you, Christy, and thanks to all of you for coming out. I'm very happy to be here today to talk to you about both the past and the future in water. Water's a big topic. I'm going to cover a range of issues tonight, and I'm sure I'll leave you with more questions than answers. Let me start by saying first that as we age, both as individuals and as a society, we absorb more knowledge, we learn more things, we have more experiences. We learn from our peers, we learn from others. We face new challenges and we're presented with new opportunities. Circumstances change, conditions vary. The world evolves, often with growing complexity and diversity and interconnections. How often do we hear the comment that the world used to be a simpler place, or I wish I was born 200 years ago when life was simple, rather than have to deal with the complexities of modern society. Some of this is nostalgia, the belief that there used to be a golden age, that we're not living in the golden age anymore. And history is ripe with golden ages. There was the Athenian golden age. There was the golden age under Queen Elizabeth I in England. There was the Genroku Age in Japan, which is described as a golden age in Japan. One characteristic of golden ages is that they don't last very long. Another is that in hindsight, maybe they aren't actually as all that golden. They don't turn out to be as wonderful as we think of them. And I would argue that perhaps much of the lament for the good old days might be misplaced. And in my talk tonight, I'm going to argue that that's the case for water. that society's experience in managing fresh water, our history around fresh water, the old days were not the golden days for water. I think that overall, we're better off today than we used to be in terms of water resources, not just in the United States, which is a rich country in terms of resources and economics and knowledge and experience and education, but in much of the rest of the world as well. It's certainly true that there are bad things happening in many parts of the world around water, and I'll come back to that. But we're better off today than we used to be in many ways in water. But I also think that in many ways, better days are coming. They're in front of us. They're not behind us, but they're still to be seen. So I'm going to describe today what I call the three ages of water. I'm going to describe the new challenges that face us in water, the concept of peak water, and new approaches and tools becoming available for dealing with our complicated water problems. I'm going to talk about the soft path for water, and I'll describe what I mean by that. But I'm also going to talk about Mesopotamia, 19th century poetry, California's new plan for a peripheral tunnel, or whatever we're going to end up calling that, Sumerian myths, climate change, Kashmiri proverbs, the Green Revolution, baseball philosophy, Noel Coward, and Dante's Inferno. All of which, as you know, are closely related to fresh water. Okay, so for most of the people who have ever lived on Earth, the first age extended from really ancient times up until the end of the Middle Ages, what I call the first age in water, up until the beginning of the Renaissance, between the 14th and the 17th centuries. And the first age in water really was the simple reliance on the natural hydrologic cycle to provide the water that we needed and to get rid of the wastes, typically human wastes, that we produced. Our rivers and streams were the sources of water. We took water out when we wanted it, and they were the sinks for our detritus. And when the population of the planet was small and dispersed, that worked okay for a while. Life was pretty short and miserable anyway. People were dying of all sorts of things, and from malnutrition and poxes and plagues and water-related diseases to some degree, and the complications of childbirth. And that was the early history of humankind. And that was the first age in water. And the first age began to end when small and dispersed populations were no longer so small and no longer so dispersed, and when communities started to grow, and when concentrations of people required more centralized water services than simply taking water out and dumping waste in our streams was adequate. And so that was the beginning of the second age, when isolated pockets of civilization really began to coalesce around the agricultural fields of Mesopotamia and in the Indus Valley in southern Asia in particular, in the earliest cities of the Romans and the Greeks, when they had to start to think about doing different things with water to meet the needs of the time. In some ways, the second age of water really began to flower in the 18th and 19th centuries. This was a period when cities in Europe and in the Americas were really starting to get big. They were reaching critical size. They were outgrowing and contaminating local water resources. The Black Death had decimated Europe, worsened by growing populations without access to safe water and sanitation, and by a society that really had a limited understanding of science and medicine and engineering. And so the subsequent Renaissance, after the Dark Ages, really, included a blossoming not just of art and science and music and natural philosophy, but a fairly rapid expansion of engineering ingenuity around water. An important part of that scientific revolution was the I don't know whether to call it discovery, but the realization of the scientific method, the idea that we could look at empirical evidence, we could formulate and test and then modify hypotheses. And early and influential proponents of the scientific method included people like Copernicus and Galileo and Francis Bacon, not, I would note, without ideological opposition, especially in the case of Galileo, as many of you may know. But the scientific method also led to great advances in medicine and astronomy and biology and physics and water. And from my point of view, especially water. But of course, historically, not especially water, because so many amazing things were happening at the time. By the early 1800s, there was a growing realization, especially in Europe, that we were really fouling our water resources. And the famous poet Coleridge wrote in 1828, quote, "The river Rhine, it is well known, doth wash the city of Cologne. But tell me, nymphs, what powers divine shall henceforth wash the river Rhine," which was a cesspool at the time. It was a smelly source for human waste. And again, some of you may remember there were periods of time when the Parliament in London had to adjourn during the summer months because it was hot, and the Thames emitted horrible, horrible stenches, and the Parliament couldn't function during the summer months because of the cesspool that was the River Thames. And for those of you who live in Southern California and read the news, or both, a horrible stench has just arisen from the Salton Sea, which is a story for today's times, and maybe I'll come back to that. But uncontrolled pollution of our water resources had consequences. By the middle part of the 19th century, cholera, dysentery, other water-related diseases were rampant in cities from Asia to Europe to the New World. Cholera outbreaks by the mid-1800s spread around the world from Asia to Europe, from Europe to the New World. Cholera arrived in New Orleans and then went up the Mississippi River and then went out the Oregon Trail to the west coast of the United States. And if any of you played the early computer game Oregon Trail, I don't know if any of you have, but my kids did. One of the bad things that happened in this funny little computer game with the Oregon Trail was people died of cholera. That was a reality of the historical period of the time. Cholera went out the Oregon Trail as part of the spread of cholera around the world. Philadelphia, Chicago, New York, London, Paris, all of these big cities experienced terrible outbreaks of cholera. Tens of thousands of people or more died in each of these outbreaks, and they didn't really know until around the middle 1800s, whether cholera was an airborne disease or a water-related disease or what. It was a mystery. But by the middle of the 1800s, scientists were beginning to put science and initial epidemiology together to try and figure out what were the causes of not just cholera, but many diseases at the time. And there's a classic story around cholera. In many ways, one of the first epidemiological mapping stories, where a guy named John Snow mapped cholera deaths in a certain neighborhood of London in the early 1850s. He was convinced it was a water-related disease. He mapped the deaths. He mapped the water pumps, the wells that were providing water. He noted that deaths were concentrated around certain wells, and he actually removed the pump handle from what he thought was the well that must be contaminated with cholera, and the outbreak of cholera in that neighborhood stopped. Even today, there's a pub, if you ever go to London, called the John Snow Pub, in which they claim to have the original pump handle, the Broad Street pump handle behind the bar. But it was a remarkable story of the growing understanding during the Second Age of Water about the relationship between water and human health. And as those connections were made, we also saw the first machines developed to provide water supply, the first physical and chemical and biological treatment systems for large centralized bodies of water. We saw the first dams of gigantic size to store water in wet periods so we could use it in dry periods, to hold back floodwaters, to produce reliable, clean electricity through hydroelectric power. We developed and deployed the technology to dig aqueducts not tens of kilometers long, but hundreds or thousands of kilometers long, to move water from where we had it to where we wanted it, through mountains sometimes, from glaciers to the deserts. We saw the first large-scale irrigation systems designed to permit farmers to grow food in large quantities at places and times never before possible. That's the second era of water, the second age of water, and we all grew up in that period of time. And we all benefited from those advances, those scientific and engineering and political and economic and epidemiological advances. Cholera and dysentery had been vanquished from the richer nations of the world. We're feeding 7 billion people today, in part because of the Green Revolution, which was a revolution of agricultural technology, but also a revolution of irrigation technology. We couldn't do that without advanced irrigation technology. Sophisticated water systems protect us to some degree from floods and droughts, and they collect our wastewater, and they treat our wastewater, and they take it away. And the reality is, we take most of it for granted. We take almost all of it for granted. Now, as an aside, California was a major beneficiary of the second age of water. In the 160 years since we've become a state, we've wrought pretty fundamental transformations of the natural ecosystem that was here before modern society was here. We've replumbed, we've channelized, we've dewatered the great Central Valley ecosystems and marshes and wetlands, the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. We built massive infrastructure to move water from north to south and from east to west to satisfy our coastal cities. San Francisco depends on massive infrastructure. We outgrew our water supply more than 100 years ago in the East Bay. Los Angeles wouldn't exist without massive transfers of water from the Colorado River, from Mono Lake, from the Central Valley water systems. We've dammed practically every one of our major rivers. There are very few undammed rivers in California. First to provide water for the gold rush, then to provide water for irrigation, now to provide water for our complicated economy. The state continues to be a global leader in the production of food and agriculture. California is a great place to grow food, and it takes a lot of water to do it. But as we've entered the 21st century, things are changing again. Water is once again taking center stage as one of the most critical, if not most critical, resource issue facing humanity. Why? Because despite the advances of the second age of water, despite our better understanding of the hydrologic cycle and our advanced technology, despite hundreds of billions of dollars or more spent on developing the water infrastructure that sustains all of us, we still have a global water crisis. We have not solved all of our water problems. And not only have we not solved our traditional water problems, but there are new water problems that are coming down the road that we have to deal with, that we're not fully cognizant of, or we don't fully understand, or that we are not prepared to address. And let me draw a distinction between when I say there's a global water crisis. I'll talk about why I believe there's a global water crisis. But in many ways, the truth is our water crisis is a lot of local water crises. Water is a local issue, ultimately. And our water problems vary from place to place. The water problems here are different than the water problems there. The water problems in the United States are different than the water problems in developing countries. There are similarities. There are analogies to be made. There are technologies that apply equally in different places. But one of the challenges to solving our water problem is first understanding the diverse nature of our water problems, and then trying to apply the proper solutions in the proper places at the proper time. And we're not very good at that. But I also believe there is a global problem with water. And let me describe what the nature of our local and our global water problems are. First of all, population is growing, and we're failing to meet basic human needs for water supply and sanitation. any environmental talk, I think, is remiss if it doesn't address population. And I'm not going to talk much about population except to acknowledge that there's probably no problem that we face that is easier to solve with a big population than with a smaller population. And we ought to talk more about population, but we don't. And it's a fundamental piece of the water problem, because we're running as fast as we can to meet basic human needs for water and sanitation, and it's difficult with the speed with which populations are growing, especially in some of the most water-scarce parts of the world, in northern Africa, in the Middle East, and in parts of Asia. Billions of people still lack access to safe drinking water, and sanitation. Probably 800 or 900 million people don't have access to safe water. 2.5 billion people don't have access to adequate sanitation services, something all of us in this room take for granted, I would argue. And I would note, this is why population is so important. I say around 2.5 billion people don't have access to adequate sanitation. So that means, 4.5 billion do. But 2.5 billion people is more people than were on the planet in 1940. The population has grown so much, we've managed to provide 4.5 billion people with adequate sanitation, but there are more people today without adequate sanitation than were on the planet in 1940. That's the problem with population growth, with exponential population growth. And the consequences of failing to meet basic human needs for water are water-related diseases. Cholera, dysentery, typhoid, guinea worm. There are a whole series of diseases that we don't think about much in the United States and in the developed world, but are the consequence of drinking contaminated water or being exposed to human waste without adequate sanitation. And they're, in my opinion, entirely preventable. We know how to prevent water-related diseases, but we fail to prevent them because we fail to meet basic human needs for water supply and sanitation. And one of the consequences is around 2 to 5 million deaths a year from water-related diseases, mostly children under the age of 5. And I think that's a global crisis. You could quibble with the word crisis, but don't quibble with me, because I think that's a global crisis. And I think it's the most fundamental development failure of the 20th century, of the second age of water. Despite all of the advances, we've failed to do this most basic thing. A second problem is that we haven't solved water quality problems. Even in the richer developed countries of the world, water quality problems still challenge us, both human wastes and industrial wastes. And they challenge us in new ways. There are new industrial contaminants that we don't know of, or we don't understand the consequences of, or we don't know how to remove from water. And there's an old Kashmiri proverb that says, "It is easy to throw anything into the river, but difficult to take it out again." And that's the problem. For too long, in the first age of water and the second age of water, we treated our natural hydrologic system, our rivers and our lakes and our streams, as places to get rid of our wastes. We have a water, a sanitation system in the United States that depends on water. I forget who said it. I should have looked it up for this talk. But somebody said, if there's an alien civilization out there looking at us, they're probably saying, "Oh yeah, Earth, that's where those people put their human wastes into the water. How bizarre." And I think that's maybe not what we want to be known for. But we have serious unresolved water quality challenges as well. Third, food production requires water. And while we've done remarkable things with food production, there are some new challenges that we've not dealt with. The first one is that the area of irrigated land worldwide... Actually, let me back up and just give you a number to think about. 16% or 17% or 18% of the cropland worldwide is irrigated. The rest is rain-fed agriculture. But that approximately 16% of irrigated land produces around 40% of the world's food. It's really important. Hence my earlier comment about the Green Revolution and irrigation. Irrigation is really important. Rain-fed agriculture is really important, too. We have to do better with both. but the area of irrigated land worldwide is barely growing now. It's very difficult to bring more land under irrigated production for a number of reasons, one of which is most of the good land that can be irrigated is being irrigated. Another is water. It's hard to find water, more water, to irrigate more land. Look at California. We're tapped out. There is more land in California that could be irrigated from a quality perspective, quality of the land, the soils. But where's the water going to come from? And that's a debate we've been having in California for 50 years and we'll probably have for another 50 years, but it's indicative of the nature of the problem. Population is growing faster than our additions to irrigated land. And that's a challenge. So from that perspective alone, we have to get more and more food from the land and the water that we're already mobilizing. We have to become more productive. Another part of the food problem, and this is a really important part of the problem, is that much of our food production today worldwide comes from unsustainable overdraft of groundwater. Again, as much as 40% of our food production worldwide comes from unsustainable groundwater production, by which I mean groundwater that we pump out faster than it's naturally recharged. There's lots of groundwater worldwide. It's recharged naturally by rainfall that seeps into the ground and goes down into our aquifers. But when you pump it out faster than it's naturally recharged, groundwater levels drop. As groundwater levels drop, it becomes more expensive to pump because there's an energy cost to do that. I came earlier today from a conference over in Berkeley on clean tech focused on water, and there was a guy there who grew up in India and described when he was a child the wells in his village. You could look down into the well, and there was the water. And today they're drilling wells to 200 feet, and they're not finding water because the groundwater levels have dropped so far. And that's a problem in the Central Valley of California, and it's a problem in India, and it's a problem in China. We are overdrafting groundwater unsustainably to produce a lot of our food. And the population continues to grow. That's out of balance by any sense of the term. Fourth, the conflict between human uses of water and ecosystem uses of water, those conflicts are growing. We take water out of the natural ecosystems that also require water. And ecosystems typically don't have a voice politically, and they don't have a wallet economically, and so that's what we've done. And again, in the first age of water, when the populations were small, that didn't matter that much. But populations are no longer small, and the ecosystem consequences of our water use are significant, and they're growing. The Aral Sea, devastated by withdrawals of water from the Amu Darya and the Sir Darya rivers in the former Soviet Union. All 24 species of fish that were found only in the Aral Sea are now extinct because of human use of water from the Aral Sea. The Bay Delta here in California, the Everglades, Chesapeake Bay on the East Coast. Many river deltas around the world no longer get water because all of the water is taken out. The Colorado River in the United States and Mexico, the Yellow in China, the Nile River in Egypt and northern Africa, and those river deltas are examples of ecosystems suffering from human use of water. Another ecosystem problem, another environmental problem is the climate. We are changing the climate. And that's going to have serious implications for water. The hydrologic cycle is the climate system. Evaporation, formation of clouds, precipitation, runoff, evaporation. That's the hydrologic cycle, which you all remember from elementary school. That's the climate system also. The hydrologic cycle is part of the climate system. There is growing evidence that these changes in climate and implications for the hydrologic system will be felt not just globally, but locally through increases in water demand as temperature goes up, through changes in rainfall patterns, through changes in the frequency and intensity of droughts and floods, through disappearance of snow and ice, and more. And worse, it's increasingly apparent that we've waited far too long to act to prevent climate disasters from accelerating. Fifth, water and politics makes a volatile combination. I'm a scientist by training in hydrology and climatology, but you can't work in water without thinking about politics. Competition for fresh water is growing. Competition between regions, competition between users of water and sectors of our society and economy. And along with that competition comes the risk of violence over water resources and allocation. Now, water has for millennia been a source of tension over water. It's been a target of war. It's been a tool of violence. It's been a political issue. Fights over water, fights with water, are found throughout history. Through Sumerian, there are discussions of conflicts over water in Sumerian myths and legends in history. There was a war between the ancient cities of Uma and Lagash in Mesopotamia 5,000 years ago. And then just a week or so ago, there were news reports of a dozen people killed in Kenya in conflicts over water and land. One of the things we do at the Pacific Institute is we maintain something called the Water Conflict Chronology. For those of you interested in history or water, and presumably you're interested in water, we keep a history of conflicts over water going back 5,000 years. It's a database. You can map conflicts over water. You can look by region. You can look by time period. Google Water Conflict Chronology, and you'll find it. Or go to worldwater.org. It's there. We may not see wars over water. Wars start for a lot of different reasons. It's hard to imagine a war about any one cause, per se. Wars are complicated things. But we already see conflict and violence and death over allocations and disputes over water resources. All of these broad problems, the access to water, water quality issues, environmental issues, water and politics, are mirrored in California. Population growth and scarcity. The failure to meet basic human needs for water and basic ecosystem needs for water. There are populations in the Central Valley of California that do not have safe drinking water. Latino communities in particular, in the agricultural sectors where they're not on high-quality municipal supplies. They're drinking groundwater that's often contaminated, especially with nitrates from inadequate sewer systems or agricultural systems, or there are all sorts of sources of nitrates. Again, the Pacific Institute did an analysis of the cost, the economic and health costs to some of these communities that in California that don't have access to safe drinking water, but they're often invisible to us. Water quality degradation, food production and conflicts with other users, agriculture, the conflict between agricultural users and urban users in California, and the environment is a characteristic of our conditions here. Climate change and water, we already see implications in California, and of course, water and politics. Now, I believe that many of the problems we face in water stem from the fact that we're, in many parts of the world, reaching what I'd like to call peak water. A colleague of mine, Mina Palanyapan at the Pacific Institute, and I wrote a paper a year and a half ago or 2 years ago now for the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, defining three different peak water terms: peak renewable water, peak non-renewable water, and peak ecological water. In short, what the concept of peak water is telling us is that despite the fact that water is a renewable resource, a classic renewable resource, we are increasingly running up against limits. Physical limits, chemical limits, economic limits, political limits to the amount of water that we can take and use. And those peak water limits are imposing constraints on us, on what we can choose to do with the water that's available to us, and how we can do it, and where we can do it. And these peak water limits contribute to every one of the problems that I've already described. We run into peak renewable limits when we take all of the water out of a river or stream. It doesn't mean that next year there won't be more water in the river and stream. Water is a renewable resource. But peak renewable water means that once you've taken all of the water out of a river or stream, you can't take any more. There isn't any more. That's a renewable limit. The cycle imposes constraints on how much you can take. And the Colorado River, we take it all. We would love to have more water out of the Colorado River, but we can't. That's a renewable limit. We run into peak non-renewable limits when we take more water out of groundwater than is naturally recharged. Water can be a non-renewable resource, exactly like oil. When we take it out faster than it's recharged, it's a non-renewable resource. And the examples I've given you about groundwater overdraft are peak non-renewable limits that we are facing. We run into peak ecological limits when our use of water causes more ecological harm than we get benefits out of that water use. And it's hard to measure. We're bad at measuring ecological damage. We're bad at valuing ecological values. But I would argue that in more and more places around the world, we're running into peak ecological limits, and that that's beginning to constrain our ability to do things with the water that we want to do. And the Bay Delta, again, is an example of a system that I would argue is past its peak ecological limit. Lake Erie in the 1960s, before the Clean Water Act, was a system where we passed peak ecological limits, and so on. Now, our first traditional reaction to these problems is that we just need to pay more attention to water, that we need to do more of the things we've done in the past, in the second age of water. But I'd like to argue that doing more of those things is a good idea sometimes and necessary sometimes, but isn't going to be enough. That the methods and tools we used in the second age of water brought enormous benefits to us, but that they also brought some unexpected costs, economic costs, environmental costs, political costs that I've already described, and they didn't solve all of our problems. I think it's time to look for new ideas and new answers. So here's the good news. The second age of water is ending. As the first age ended when the things we did in the first age were no longer good enough, though I think the second age of water is ending because the things we did in the second age are proving no longer to be adequate, and it's time to make a transition. And I think we're living in a period of transition. I actually think it's very exciting. It's hard to... I'm getting older, and my appreciation of history is increasing. I think things are changing, and I think I'm sort of optimistic that we're moving into what I call the third age of water, which ultimately I hope will mean a sustainable age of water. And we're not there yet, and we don't see it yet, but I think we see where we need to go. And in addition, I think we see some of the tools and the methods and the ideas that are going to get us there. And so let me talk about a positive vision for the future. Before I do, a little caveat about fortune-telling and looking into the future. My wife and I just went to see Blythe Spirit at the Cal Shakes over in Orinda. It's a play by Noel Coward. I don't know how many of you have seen it or know the story. It's about a medium, a mystic, who accidentally, successfully brings a spirit back from the dead who comically then haunts her former husband and his new wife. But there's a line in Blythe Spirit in which she actually mocks fortune tellers, as does Dante in the Inferno when he places fortune tellers in the eighth circle of hell. And that's a story which I'm not going to tell you tonight. But Dante's Inferno is a great book, and go look about it. Go look and see what he says about fortune tellers. But what the character in Blythe Spirit says, one of the other characters asks the medium, "Can you foretell the future?" She wants her fortune told. And Madame Arcati, who's the medium, answers, quote, "Certainly not. I disapprove of fortune tellers most strongly. Too much guesswork and fake mixed up with it." So with that caveat, I'm going to do a little fortune telling. I apologize, because my crystal ball is really no better than your crystal ball. But here's what I see. I can see a world in which the human right to water is acknowledged and where basic water and sanitation is met for everyone on the planet, where water is properly priced and allocated, where cities and farms collaborate, don't fight, but collaborate about water policy, where water quality is universally monitored and protected, where we grow more food with less water, where aquatic ecosystems are carefully protected and restored, invasive species are not altering our aquatic ecosystems or increasing demand for water in other ways, where groundwater pumping is brought into sustainable limits, where conflicts of water are addressed diplomatically and socially, not militarily. So let me describe what I call the soft path for water that will help move us toward this third age of water. First of all, as you might imagine, I think it's critical that we refocus our efforts and meet basic human needs for water and sanitation as a top priority for everyone, independent of economics. That governments and international aid organizations and corporations and private groups at all levels, many of whom are working very hard on this issue, join forces to meet that goal of providing a minimum amount of clean and safe and affordable water for everyone as a fundamental human right. And I would note that 2 years ago, almost to the day, the UN Human Rights Council, after decades of discussion and debate, formally declared a binding human right to water that talks about meeting these basic human needs for water and sanitation, both. It was a remarkable thing. The economic costs of meeting basic human needs for water for everyone on the planet are tiny compared to the amount of money we spend on a lot of other things. And I won't make the typical comparisons with military budgets, but you can make them. The estimate is that maybe $40 or $50 billion a year investment in meeting basic human needs for water and sanitation would solve the problem over the next coming decades incrementally. $40 or $50 billion, I mean, we're past the point of talking about that as a lot of money at the global level. I just point that out. And I would also say the economic costs of not meeting those needs are far in excess of that. The cost to women in lost time and opportunity, because it's women who have to walk for miles in Africa, especially to find water for their families, that the lost economic opportunity, the economic costs associated with the health failures to provide basic water and sanitation are many, many times larger than that amount of money. And efforts are underway to do this. They're inadequate, but they're underway. And I think the U.S. could be a big player in this. We could do far more with the technology, the money, the educational resources, the infrastructure that we have in helping the world move in that direction. Second, we have to address the wrongs done to our environment in the name of water development. It's possible to move back from peak ecological water toward a more sustainable system. It's time to guarantee that basic water needs for ecosystems are met as well as basic human needs for water. Restore basic river flows, restore fisheries and ecosystems, and there are efforts underway in California, in the East, in the Everglades, and in Chesapeake Bay. There are actually guarantees in the South African Constitution for basic human needs for water and basic ecosystem needs for water in the Constitution of South Africa. We'd all love to rewrite the Constitution somehow, but in the absence of that, I still think there are enormously positive things that can be done locally and worldwide to move back from peak ecological water. We're also going to have to deal with the issue of climate change and its implications for the hydrologic cycle. We've built and operated our water systems on the fundamental assumption, that tomorrow's climate is going to look like yesterday's climate. We build dams based on our understanding of flood frequency. We operate our systems based on assumptions about river flow. Those assumptions are no longer correct. The future climate is not going to be the same as the past climate, and we're not very good yet at integrating that into our management, into our planning, into our operations. There are a lot of things that we can do to reduce our vulnerability to the climate changes that we're not going to be able to avoid. We're not going to be able to avoid some climate changes, and so we'd better think about here's the way to think about it. Our options for climate change are three: mitigation, adaptation, and suffering. And that is mitigation of greenhouse gases and the impacts of climate change, adaptation to those impacts we can't avoid, and suffering. And really, the only question, that's not my formulation, But the only question really is, what's going to be the balance among those three things? We have to do all, we're going to do all of them. Third, we have to rethink both supply and demand for water. Supply used to mean build another dam, drill another groundwater well, build another aqueduct to move water from the next river basin over once we've used up the natural supply where in our local basins. There are increasing constraints on supply, as I've talked about, but that doesn't mean there aren't innovative things we can do in terms of supply. I think there's new thinking that we need to do about supply. So, for example, wastewater. We collect a lot of our wastewater, we treat it to a pretty high standard, and then we throw it away. We dump it in the ocean, or we get rid of it. I think wastewater should be thought of as an asset, not a liability. We treat that stuff to a pretty high standard, and the reality is we could treat it to incredibly pure standards. And they do in Singapore, where they reuse a lot of their wastewater. They call it new water. They treat it to an incredibly high standard. It's an asset, not a liability. EdMud, the East Bay Municipal Utilities District, which is my water supplier over in the East Bay, is increasing its use of treated wastewater for different kinds of things. It doesn't have to be potable. It could be used for watering outdoor landscaping. It's used for power plant cooling or industrial cooling. Let's think about that as a source of supply. Rainwater harvesting is a source of supply. Desalination is a source of new supply. New supply doesn't necessarily mean destroying another natural river or tapping another non-sustainable groundwater aquifer. And that's already happening too. But we also have to rethink demand. The assumption, again, with demand has always been, in the second age of water, that whatever the demand for water is, we'll meet it. Populations grow, demand grows, we'll figure out how to supply that demand. But I'd like to suggest that there is inefficient and wasteful use of water in every sector of our society. Every one of our water uses, pretty much, is inefficient. That we could do more with the water we're already using. Our goal is not to use water. Our goal is to produce goods and services. Our goal is to grow food, to get rid of wastes, to make semiconductors, to wash our clothes. Lots of the things we want to do, lots of those goods and services require water, but to the extent that those things require less water than we're spending to do those things, that's productivity. Let's increase our productive use of water, and that's the demand side of the equation, and we haven't given the demand side of the equation enough attention. Fourth, we have to protect water quality. A top priority has to be protecting the quality of our tap water. I wrote a book called Bottled, and I'm not going to talk about bottled water tonight, but I wrote a book about bottled water and talking about why people drink bottled water and the bottled water industry and some of the peculiar things with the bottled water industry. But part of the reason people drink more and more bottled water, and we're drinking more and more bottled water, is that increasingly we're afraid of our tap water. Valid or not, people increasingly fear our tap water, and to some degree the bottled water industry plays on that. But I would be the first to acknowledge that our tap water could be even better. We have an incredible tap water system in this country, a tap water system most of the rest of the world wish they had. But it could be better. There are things in our tap water that either weren't there before or aren't regulated or we're just now able to measure because of our ability to measure smaller and smaller quantities of pollutants. We don't fully understand those things. We don't adequately regulate them. Let's deal with them. Let's regulate the ones that are bad. Let's remove the ones. We know how. We have the technology. It's not magic technology. Let's protect our tap water and improve our tap water. It'll reduce the demand for bottled water. It'll protect public health. It's the right thing to do. But our water laws are outdated. The Safe Drinking Water Act, the Clean Water Act, need to be brought into the 21st century. And they haven't been, and it doesn't look like this Congress is going to do that. But that's a fundamental challenge for us in terms of water quality. My colleagues and I wrote a book called The 21st Century U.S. Water Policy. It's out there. It's brand new, just was published a couple of weeks ago. It makes suggestions on this side of the equation for what we ought to do at the national level as well. We should recognize that different uses of water require different qualities of water. Why do we use potable water to water our lawns? Why do we have lawns? Some of you might be wondering. But let's use the right quality of water to do the right task, and that can help reduce pressure on water resources. Fifth, let's use smart economics to tackle our water problem. The failure to price water properly leads to overuse and inefficient use. But let's price water fairly as well. Water's a human right. It's also an economic good. No one should be denied water because of an inability to pay for it. There's a human right to water. The UN was pretty clear that those of us who can afford to pay for water, the human right to water doesn't mean we ought to get it free. Water might be free, but who's paying for the pipes and the treatment system? And that's a political debate. And the reality is most of us pay too little for water. Our water bills are probably, this is true for probably every one of you, our water bills are lower than our energy bills and our mobile phone bill and our internet access bill and our cable TV bill and our phone bill. You get the idea. Which one of those really can you do without? We should pay more for water. We should also get rid of the subsidies, the bad subsidies for water. We sometimes subsidize things that increase our water use in ways that, in hindsight, are not all that smart. Let's use smart economics. Let's develop markets for water where they're appropriate. And that balancing that water is an economic good and a social good is an important piece of this. Finally, let's improve our water institutions. Charles Darwin said, "If the misery of our poor be caused not by the laws of nature but by our institutions, great is our sin," end of quote. And the truth is, in many ways, the misery of our poor is caused by our institutions, not by nature. And that's true in water as well. Let's manage water, not for the second age of water, but for the third age of water. Let's manage water for the sustainable future that is possible if we can think about where we want to be. And that means our institutions are going to have to change, our universities are going to have to change what they teach and how they teach it and reach out to more than just engineers and men, which was the model of the second age of water. It means utilities are going to have to rethink water planning and management. It means we're going to have to see new collaborative efforts between and among farmers and environmentalists and urban water users and planners. We need to think about the energy sector. It takes a tremendous amount of energy to produce and use our water, and a lot of water to produce and use energy. Let's think about integrating across sectors and their innovative things that we can do. Let's streamline government regulations without reducing the protection that those regulations provide. We have to understand the importance of regulatory issues as well. So, what will the future really bring? Can we reach a rosy future, or are we condemned to a perpetual water crisis? A future that maybe we can see more clearly, but that I would argue we don't want. As that famous baseball philosopher said, Casey Stengel said, never make predictions, especially about the future. And given where we are in the year, let me just say, go Giants. I don't know where we're going to end up. The gloomy pessimists and the rosy optimists don't know either. Because that depends on choices we make as individuals and economists and scientists and engineers and educators and politicians. But the third age of water means we have to shift to a new way of thinking about water. I think that shift is underway, and I hope we can continue to find ways to encourage it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California and that you are listening to The Future of Our Water, Can We Learn from the Past, with Dr. Peter Glick. We have time for just a few questions, so if there's anybody in the audience that would like to come up to this mic. Okay, we'll take the first question, please.
Professor Glick, thank you for spending the evening with us. Now, I appreciate your sort of framing this, if not generational, then at least societal changeover in the history of water, perhaps if I could reframe it as the era of dependence on water as we find it, the era of control over water, and now the era of responsibility for our water. What I would like to ask you is some of the points that you touched on, but perhaps could expand on more. If we are going to be responsible for our water in this context, rewrite the Clean Water Act, as you mentioned, do many of the other things that have been held over from our historical associations, what governance structures are emerging now that you think are promising and would like to see more political support for, because it will ultimately be political, for the more rational and scientific consideration of how we use our water? What measures are we developing to be able to measure that use, to make our decisions based on information and not guesstimation? And then thirdly, how are we evolving our relationship with the silent 98% of the water in the oceans? Because our governance there and our general dealing with those is both balkanized and in many cases utterly unplanned.
Great questions. I'll inadequately answer a few of them at least. On the governance side, governance and institutions is a key part of this, and I hinted at that toward the end. Water is often, usually, local, and I'm a big fan of managing water at the lowest appropriate level. Water should be managed locally, by the watershed level, the water district level, the community level. Some of the most innovative and effective and successful examples of addressing water and sanitation problems in Africa are when communities get together and decide really what they want, not what some NGO with good technology brings them, but what they really want in terms of management. I mentioned we have a new book about U.S. water policy. There are certain things that ought to be done at the national level. Not everything, in fact, not most things, but certain things. So, for example, we don't want 50 separate state water quality laws. We want a national water quality law, and that's what the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act deal with. And we want the federal government to better be involved at the State Department level with diplomatic negotiations on water conflicts. And so I don't have a good answer except to say properly develop the institutions to properly manage at the right level, depending on what the problem is. And that's going to require a little different thinking because we haven't thought about institutions that way in the past. Let me just quickly say about the oceans. I have to say I deal mostly with fresh water, which is the 2.5% of the world's water. The other 97.5% or 98% of the world's water is salt water. It's too salty to drink, too salty to grow crops with. People often ask, well, what about desalination? If we could just turn that salt water into fresh water, wouldn't that solve all of our problems? Sort of, it would, but not really. Desalination is expensive. We know how to desalinate. It's not a technological problem. It's an economic problem. It's very, very expensive. We will see more and more desalination, even eventually in California, but it's really expensive in California. And too often we get hung up on technology as a solution to our problems, desalinate. But desalination has economic challenges and environmental challenges and political challenges as well. Australia just went through a devastating 9-year drought. They've done some incredible things on efficiency. They've also just built a whole bunch of very expensive desalination plants. And now most of them have been shut down because it's wetter, the drought's gone. They've been mothballed, not closed, but mothballed. And the water's too expensive, and they're not going to run them until they need them. Well, that makes them even more expensive. So getting our relationship with technology and the oceans and desalination right is part of the challenge.
Do you have another question?
You mentioned how the UN had finally declared water a universal human right, and this battle has been going on for decades, but whether it's a human right or an economic good, and what are the conflicts between those two. Are we still seeing from the major economic institutions of the world, like the World Bank and the WTO, are they still kind of stuck in the economic mode, or how is this debate playing out, and what major world economic institutions do you think will get behind what you hope will be a movement to this third age of water, and what institutions might resist that?
Another great, difficult question. The economics of water is a tough one. It's a controversial one. Part of it is a debate, for those of you unfamiliar with it, about public versus private water and control of water. On the human rights side, the UN Declaration was actually, it's beautifully written. I actually love it. And it's very sophisticated. It doesn't say that water should be free, but it does say you can't deny somebody a basic water, their basic water needs because of inability to pay. In that sense, water is a human right. But it also says it's perfectly appropriate to charge for water or water services, and they don't wade into the public model versus private model debate. The World Bank's in that debate, utilities are in that debate, corporations are in that debate, public interest groups are in that debate. The Pacific Institute has done a lot of work on water privatization, looking at the pros and cons and the risks of and benefits of public versus private systems. There are a lot of different kinds of systems out there, and the short answer, and this is already not a short answer, I realize, because it's a tough question, is that I don't think there's any one model. There are serious risks to privatization of water, but there are some benefits. And if you understand the risks, it's possible to put in place oversight, public oversight and management of those risks. 20% of Californians get water from private water companies. They're regulated monopolies, like our electric utilities. The other 80% of Californians get water from public water agencies. Mostly, they're both well run. They both have inefficiencies and problems with them. But I think the public-private debate is not the proper... It's a debate that's going to go on for a long time. But if the objectives are well understood, meet basic human needs for water, protect ecosystems, deal with poverty around water, then... the model about how we do that, I think, is part of the discussion we have to have.
We'd also like to thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.